Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The Florida governor's campaign is in the final weeks, and it is in a dead heat. The latest polls have former Governor Charlie Crist pulling even. Some surveys even have him pulling ahead of Governor Rick Scott as the two begin direct debates. The first of three debates between Governors Scott and Crist this morning at Telemundo. It just wrapped up. The debate will be televised tonight on Spanish language stations. Joining us here on the Florida Roundup, Mike Mayo, columnist at the Sun Sentinel. Kathleen McGrory, a reporter for the Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times, joining us from Tampa. And John O'Connor from WLRN, joining us from the debate site in Florida at Telemundo here. John, let's start with you. What are some of the highlights of this debate?
It's really interesting. I mean, a lot like the campaign that we've seen so far, that there was much more, you can't vote for this guy versus here's why you should vote for me. Both the candidates, would answer a question by starting out saying what they would do very briefly and then immediately turn to what the other guy didn't do and what his shortcomings were. Probably the biggest, the most quotable line from the debate that I heard was Governor Scott, in defense of the Cuban embargo, calling the Castro brothers terrorists. That was really the strongest statement that he made. And we heard former Governor Crist mentioned many, many times, repeated it often, that you can't really trust Rick Scott. He won't give you a straight answer. I'm a guy who will give you a straight answer.
John O'Connor joining us from the debate site for the first of three gubernatorial debates just wrapping up in South Florida. John, what about the vision? Either candidate articulating a clear vision of what they'd like to do over the next 4 years if elected?
Yeah, you sit there and you listen to them, and most of what you hear is why you can't vote for the guy he's running against. Crist in particular, Mark Caputo with Miami Herald tweeted this, and I totally agree with him, did not do a great job of explaining why he should replace Scott, why he should be elected again, switching to a different party, changing some of his positions along the way. He didn't make a strong case of why he should be elected.
Mike Mayo, you've watched a number of gubernatorial debates. We will see this one tonight, overdubbed in Spanish. But the vision thing is a big thing here. And so much of this campaign has been negative. And that negative advertising, as we know, it may play to the base. But in terms of turnout, it could certainly impact it.
Yeah, to this point, advertising is what shaped the campaign. Now with debates, we can actually maybe get to some substance. But this is just weird to me that we have the first time these guys square off is in a pre-taped Spanish language format. So they actually get together now at 11 a.m. It doesn't run until 7 p.m. and it's going to be overdubbed in Spanish, which is just also weird to me because in our state constitution, we actually have an amendment that English is the official language of Florida. But now we have our two gubernatorial candidates, their first debate is in Spanish. This is kind of a dress rehearsal, I guess, for the bigger debates that are going to be coming up, two more, one next week at Broward College.
Yep.
They were, I guess, sharpening their lines and maybe getting their strategies in shape. I thought maybe the translator for Scott probably had the easiest job in the world because I thought the only thing he would answer is trabajos, trabajos, trabajos,
jobs.
And actually, he did break into Spanish at the end and did say, yo trabajo duro, I work hard. That was his closing line.
Kat McGrory with Miami Herald Tampa Bay Times with us in Tallahassee. The negativity of the ad campaign and the ad barrage sounds like it did carry over to the debate. Question is, if you're trying to land body blows in the opponent, are you helping your own campaign here? Are you providing the positive message and the vision statement of, in the case of Governor Scott, why you deserve another 4 years, or in the case of Governor Crist, why you deserve another 4 years?
Yeah, that's absolutely the thing. I think voters, by and large, are getting very sick and tired of all of this negativity, and it seemed like the debate was finally going to be the forum in which the two candidates could really put some issues on the table and kind of discuss what differentiates them. It doesn't sound like they did that.
Yeah, John, you concentrate on education. Much of a conversation about Florida state standards, education, spending, those kinds of issues that we have seen some media coverage and some advertising messages around?
Yeah, if there was a change in the conversation at all, it was about bright futures. Both of these candidates are jumping on that issue. Obviously, we've written about how they've changed the requirements and fewer students are qualifying for the scholarships. Crist jumped all over that, saying that Scott has cut access to the scholarships. That's hurting black students. It's hurting Hispanic students in a disproportionate way. Scott turned it back on Chris to say that, well, you know, you passed Bright Futures and you said that this was a way to pay for the all of college, but in fact you were allowing tuition to rise and giving false hope that Bright Futures was going to be able to pay for all of college when in fact it couldn't.
You know, financial disclosure also has come up in the last 3 or 4 days here, and the governor being sued by George Sheldon, the Democratic attorney general candidate. He's claimed that Scott has not reported more than $200 million of assets, citing the difference between the governor's public disclosure in Florida and the documents that he discloses with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, this week, the debate for the candidates for attorney general, Sheldon raised this issue, and the Republican attorney general, Pam Bondi, responded.
You know, I would call on the attorney general to begin to look at what this discrepancy is with Governor Scott between what he said on his financial disclosure to the state and what he said on his SEC filings.
That's how a politician talks, not an attorney general. And let me tell you, first of all, to imply that our governor is corrupt, that's not appropriate for any candidate to say that, nor an attorney general to say that, based on a newspaper article.
This has come up in the last 4 days or so about the forthcoming of the finances of the governor, Kat McGrory, at the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee. Is this something for Governor Crist to hang his hat on in future debates?
Well, it's really interesting because Governor Scott was someone who came in as an outsider, someone who's been promoting transparency. You know, and the Democrats are really hammering him for, you know, they're saying that, look, he failed to report, you know, what could be as much as $200 million in assets on the public financial disclosures. So could it hurt him? Yeah, it very well could. I mean, I think it certainly feeds into this narrative that the Democrats are trying to create, which is that, you know, here's a kind of sketchy guy. You look at Oliver Scott's dealings with HCA, and you ought to be questioning him.
Mike Mayo?
Look, I think everybody knows Rick Scott is wealthy and that he has investments and that maybe in his duties as governor, some of his job duties as governor might be helping some of his investments. But that's not what's going to decide this race. I mean, people know that. People know all about HCA and the Medicaid fraud and all that stuff. And that was the last go-around. I think what Charlie Crist needs to do, he needs to get people to the polls, especially Democrats in voter-rich South Florida. And he's got to find a way of doing that. And I don't know if just attacking Scott over finances or possible conflicts is the best way of doing it.
Voters to the polls, including Hispanics, and that plays to the part of this first debate in the gubernatorial campaign, is on Spanish-language television. We will talk more about that. And also the debate to be Florida's top prosecutor. And medical marijuana and same-sex marriage, all still ahead as the Florida Roundup continues after this. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Mike Mayo of the Sun Sentinel is along with us here in studio in Miami. Kathleen McGrory joining us from Tallahassee. She writes about politics for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. The first Florida gubernatorial debate just wrapped up, a taping of it for Spanish language television. It will be on the air on Telemundo this evening at 7 p.m. It was conducted with the two candidates answering in English. Those answers, Mike Mayo, will be overdubbed into Spanish for that Spanish language audience. And as we mentioned, that's a key audience for these two candidates for governor. It could be the swing vote for governor at the top of the ticket.
Yeah, obviously Hispanic vote and Hispanic turnout is going to be one of the keys to this very, very close election. So that is why we have this debate going to Telemundo. I'm still a little bit mystified about why it's the opening one. I would think more logically it would be in the middle. But
well,
again,
let's talk a little bit about process here. Kat McGrory with the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times. Three debates these candidates have agreed to. Governor Crist wanted more. Governor Scott agreed to three. This first one overdubbed in Spanish. And then the next one will be next Wednesday night, held at Broward College here in Davie, and that will be on the radio here on WLRN as well. So we'll get three debates here. Any surprise to you that the first one is directed to the Spanish language audience?
You know, I agree with Mike on some levels that it is surprising that the first one would go to the Spanish language audience, but on some levels not surprising, because that really is going to be a key segment of voters. I mean, Charlie Crist is really going to need to get voter turnout among Hispanics, particularly in Broward County and Miami-Dade County.
Yeah. Well, Javier is joining us from Coral Gables. He wants to talk about the fact that this first governor's debate will be in Spanish. Javier, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hello, how are you? Yeah, I was a little surprised when Mr. Mayo said a little while ago that, you know, given this statutory requirement that the official language being English, that this somehow is the first debate. I think that we are the primary demographic as a Hispanic for this particular election, in which, to be sure, we're talking about two candidates that, at least in the minds of the voters, there isn't a great deal of difference. Maybe politically there will be, and certainly consequences there will be. But, you know, we're talking about a former Republican turned Democrat who, you know, has had a change of mind in many occasions, and a person who was a Republican but was, until the other day, not really a non-politician. So this is a situation where it would probably be a very thin margin, and the primary vote getters should be Hispanic. And I'm not sure. I would agree with the opinion that for some reason this is a debate that is sort of an introduction to the other debates. I think it's a very important debate, and it's probably the one that's going to make the election.
Strategically, maybe, Mike, it makes a lot of sense considering the Hispanic vote could be the swing vote.
Yeah,
here.
And my comment was meant in jest, but that there is actually in our state constitution.
You didn't come across that way.
Okay. Well, I guess my sarcasm inflection.
Sarcasm's tough on the radio.
Yeah, I guess. But right. But the point is this. You know, most of the voters who are going to be going to the polls statewide are English speaking, even though obviously, in this market, there's a greater number of the Hispanic and Spanish speakers. And again, it's just a matter of, I'm surprised that this is the first one, but you're saying, okay, it's not an introduction. However, you know, some of the questions were pointed more towards the Hispanic and Latino audience, questions about Cuba.
Yeah, but beyond Cuba, and Javier, I'm curious to your impression here, beyond the Cuba embargo question, questions about immigration status, questions about undocumented student tuition, these are questions about Florida. These aren't Hispanic questions. They're not Broward questions. They're not Tallahassee questions. They're Florida questions.
We're a constituency, just like anybody else is a constituency in Florida. And these are politicians who want our vote. So it makes sense that they would tailor their argument to the particular constituency. You're right. Their broader perspectives as governors, they may or may not, because some of them are federal questions, may have an impact on. But primarily, my perspective is this is a group of voters that they have to get in either way for them to actually win this particular election.
Absolutely right. I mean, and this debate highlights how important the Hispanic vote has become and the Spanish speaking vote in Florida. And you know, I guess there's been a lot of knocks about, you know, it's still staying negative and they're taking shots at each other, but there were some policy issues debated. And, you know, one thing that there's a clear delineation between the candidates, minimum wage. And Charlie Crist said he supports raising the minimum wage to $10.10 in this debate. And Rick Scott says, no, that would be bad for businesses. So I think we are seeing some things which can have pocketbook effects on both employees and employers. And they've marked out their territory in the debate, like it should be.
Javier, thank you for the call. Kat McGrory with Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee. Governor Scott has kind of evolved his approach to immigration as the election has drawn near. He did put his gubernatorial support behind the undocumented student tuition bill, for instance, in this past legislative session. Was this political expediency, or did we see truly a kind of a philosophical shift in the governor in his 4 years in office?
Well, that whole debate was absolutely fascinating, because we've seen lawmakers for the past 10 years try to pass, a bill that would look at tuition for undocumented students. And Republicans tried, Democrats tried, and yet it got zero traction for years and years and years. And then this year, you know, kind of on the heels of this big election, we see Governor Scott come out in support of it. So I think a lot of folks were surprised, and a lot of people said that, yes, this looks like he's doing this just to score some points with Hispanic voters. Well, when you talk to him about it, you know, he'll be the first to tell you that this is something that he truly believes in, and that access to education is something that he believes in. And, you know, you do kind of see some Go ahead.
But wasn't this a governor who at one point supported an Arizona-style, you know, hardcore immigration act?
Right, and so shifting the debate not about immigration but about access to education.
Right. Well, yeah, so he could pivot that way, but it's still like in his perfect world, though, those dreamers would never even get here to get their tuition in state, I guess.
Right, but I think if he, you know, just from his camp's perspective, if he kept the message on this is about access to education, that it was kind of consistent with some of his other perspectives because he has been pushing, you know, to lower the cost of college tuition for folks across the state. So there were some consistencies, but I do agree with you, Mike, that yes, we did see a big pivot on that, you know, particularly as it relates to the immigration issue.
That's Kat McGrory covering politics from Tallahassee for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. The Mike she refers to is Michael Mayo, columnist for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. You can join the conversation online at WLRN.org, live web chat happening now, or on Twitter. Use the handle at WLRN. The state of Florida recognized a same-sex marriage this week. Carol Goldwasser and Arlene Goldberg had been partners for 47 years. They were married in New York State, where same-sex marriages are legal. Goldwasser died in August, but this week her partner received a reissued death certificate listing Goldwasser as married. Under a judge's order, the state of Florida amended the death notice 2 weeks ago and sent it out. Now, this comes, of course, as the U.S. Supreme Court this week cleared the way for same-sex marriage. Maybe. The high court decided not to hear arguments from five states wanting to stop gay marriage from happening. Florida's constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage was struck down by a federal district court in northern Florida. That decision is waiting for an appeal. Leading the effort here, guys, to keep Florida's legal definition of a marriage as between, quote, only one man and one woman, end quote, is the current Attorney General Pam Bondi. She was asked about it Monday during a debate with her challengers.
Absolutely. Any thought to now giving up the defense like a lot of people are suggesting?
Well, there are other cases in other states. The Sixth Circuit, in fact, is still out there pending. So we're going to see what they do in the Sixth Circuit. We're going to be looking at other cases. We're going to be reviewing everything in Florida to see what to do next.
Now, her Democratic challengers, George Sheldon and Libertarian candidate Bill Wulsifer, responded.
That there is no conflict in the circuits, and we ought to be doing the same thing here.
I think the Attorney General exhausted a lot of resources of the citizens of the state.
The two challengers for AG, Mike Mayo, want to drop, the opposition to same-sex marriage. Should Florida's official opposition continue, let us know online at WLRN.org or on Twitter at WLRN. Pam Bondi continuing the fight. Her challengers say the AG ought to drop it.
Yeah, and I'm writing a column about this for Sunday's paper, which might surprise some people, because I'm fully in support of equality for all marriages, whether it's heterosexual or gays. But I think we need to get clear delineation from our top courts, both the U.S. Supreme Court and the Florida Supreme Court, especially in the case of Florida, because we had 4.8 million voters go to the polls and basically approve this discriminatory ban on gay marriage back in 2008. It wasn't that long ago. Mm-hmm. So what I think Pam Bondi is doing, she is defending and protecting the Florida Constitution, which is her job. And I think it is actually as misguided as I think the voters were and as perverse as I think, you know, her crusade is. I think it's correct for her to keep going all the way. And the only reason, you know, I think some of the advocates are overstating what the Supreme Court did or did not do this week. They declined to take up the case because there is no conflict so far in all these rulings.
They declined to take up a specific set of cases from an appeals district, which does not include Florida.
Exactly. So Florida, we still haven't, you know, gotten there up all the way up the various food chains. And I think it's also worth pointing out that the Florida Supreme Court, the last time they really had any kind of, the last time they addressed this issue was in March of 2006 when they greenlighted this amendment to get on the ballot.
Right, which voters did approve in 2008, Kat McGrory, but haven't we seen public opinion shift pretty considerably in terms of the acceptance of same-sex marriage in Florida? And is this the defining issue in the fight to be the top prosecutor in Florida?
I certainly think it's one of them, and I think we've seen kind of public opinion change in Florida for sure, but we've seen it change across the country, really. State after state has been, you know, allowing same-sex marriage, and I think that that's put a lot of pressure on Florida. I mean, you've got advocacy groups like Equality Florida and Save Dade who have been doing an awful lot of work around this issue. You've got additional pressure from Democrats, you know, who are in a very hotly contested gubernatorial race right now. You know, there seems to be all the momentum in the world.
How does this issue in this attorney general's race reflect on the race for governor, Kat?
How does it reflect on the race for governor?
Yeah, the top.
The question is, you know, is this going to be an issue that's going to really drive people to the polls? You know, at some point, folks were thinking, well, you know, if Pam Bondi and Rick Scott continue to, you know, to block this, you know, they continue the appeals process, that this was really going to upset the advocacy community and that they were going to be able to mobilize, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of voters across the state.
But on the flip side, this might be the kind of, you know, wedge issue
right.
that would galvanize conservative base to turn
The conservative right, exactly. So I don't know that anybody really has an answer to that.
And when Pam Bondi talks about you know, studying the cases, Mike Mayo says the AG is just doing her job by defending the Florida Constitution as approved by this amendment, as approved by Florida voters.
Yeah, 4.8 million voters. I think we, out of respect to them, even if you disagree with how they voted, I think this process needs to go all the way to get clear delineation from the highest courts available.
And that's, I mean, would you say, Kat, that's what we've heard from the AG's office, from Pam Bondi's office, that this needs to move forward? There's a process involved here, and that's why we're filing these appeals?
Yeah, that's what we've seen for sure. But what's kind of interesting is that, you know, with the federal case here, you know, there was a stay issued after the judge in that case ruled it the ban unconstitutional, and the stay was contingent on what happened at the Supreme Court level. You know, since the Supreme Court is not taking that up, now we've got the ACLU, you know, asking the judge in that case to lift the ban.
Right.
You know, and we're going to have to see what happens there. You know, is the attorney general going to step in, and is she going to appeal that motion? Mm-hmm. Will she allow that to go forward? We don't really know yet.
We have a comment from Twitter mentioning the gubernatorial debate earlier today, saying that Governor Crist did make a comment in the debate saying that government intrusion into private lives is wrong. Both of these candidates clearly are being asked about the same-sex marriage issue in this debate today, as well as in debates to come. We got plenty more to come as well here on the Florida Roundup. The King Tide comes to South Florida, as well as the death of a dictator in Haiti. We're back on a pledge edition of the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. So this happens about every 6 months or so. The Earth, Moon, and Sun align. Then the Moon is closest to the Earth. And when high tide comes during that alignment, it's a king tide. And the king came calling on South Florida's coastlines this week. But on Miami Beach, low-lying streets were uncharacteristically dry thanks to millions of dollars of pumps. Mayor Philip Levine sounded a hopeful note on Tuesday before the peak of King Tide.
We've seen some relief already, and I think what we're showing is in the areas where we have installed the pumps, we're seeing the water get taken up quicker. But, of course, there are areas of the city that we have not installed pumps, so we're at the early stages.
That was the early stages of the King Tide this week. Mike Mayo continues with us from the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Joy Fletcher with the Miami Herald joins us from our studios at the Miami Herald. Joy, you were on Miami Beach on the places where we've seen high tide flooding on the streets prior. How would you describe what the beach experienced on Thursday?
Well, it was pretty dry, actually. There were a couple of puddles that had formed in some drainage areas, but nothing big, nothing like the scenes from before when you'd see people wading with rain boots and cars splashing all over, even sandbags in a couple of businesses. It was nothing like that.
Has the king been slayed at Miami Beach then?
Temporarily so. It's even the city engineers I've talked to have said that this is a temporary solution. It's short-term, 30 to 40 years, they're thinking, considering sea level rise. But for now, the pumps are working.
Talk to us about the investment. $15 million of pumps were plugged in to fight this week, but this is a much larger project, isn't it?
It is. They're looking at about $500 million during the next 5 years to put in a total of nearly 60 pumps. That's up and down the beach. So there were a couple of areas like Indian Creek that did have water come up over the seawall, and there's going to be problem areas up and down the whole island. They want to address all of them.
Of course, Mike Mayo, Miami Beach is not alone in its efforts to fight back these king tides. We saw certainly the impact of high seas a year or so ago with parts of A1A that have been reconstructed.
Up in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, exactly.
Fort Lauderdale Beach. Look, this is going to be a recurring problem now, and it's only going to get worse and worse as the seas rise. And obviously, besides Miami Beach, it's all the barrier islands up and down the Gold Coast, you know, parts of Hollywood, Fort Lauderdale, Delray Beach up in Palm Beach County are susceptible to these, I guess, king tide flooding. This week wasn't as bad as feared and wasn't as bad as the past, but it doesn't mean that the steps don't need to be taken. We do need to make investments, not just for the king tides, but for overall saltwater intrusion on our drinking supplies,
sure.
All these things that are going to be coming down the pipeline 30, 40, 70 years, which politicians who are basically focused and developers who are focused on, you know, the next election cycle or the next profit quarter don't necessarily take into full consideration.
One thing that I think was different this king tide cycle, Joy, Mike, I'd like you to respond to this, was the focus of several community groups in addition to national legislators and national policymakers. We had folks from the EPA coming down here in the last couple of weeks. Of course, Senator Nelson was leading a tour on Miami Beach on Thursday at the height of king tide. It seems, Joy Fletcher for the Miami Herald, we're getting more engagement on the part of national leaders, maybe not state leaders, but certainly on the part of national leaders, arguably. Would you agree?
I would. I think that the message that they were sending there on Thursday was very strongly about climate change. It wasn't just about the king tides this year, even recent years. They were looking long term and they were saying, look, this is caused by climate change. We have to talk about carbon emissions. We need to talk about long term regulations on how we can save, how we can keep these tides down by addressing the real problem in the atmosphere.
Go ahead, Mike.
No, I just think that, you know, we're having a wake-up call, and those massive demonstrations in New York City right before the UN Climate Change Summit is it really done wonders for awareness and getting people to start thinking, more towards the future. And, you know, and in South Florida, we have to start asking more hard questions especially about barrier island development. You know, it's always amazing to me when I drive up and down these vulnerable coasts, on these narrow, narrow barrier islands like Hollywood Beach, where there's all these construction cranes and new developments.
Well, pull that into the earlier conversation, Mayo, in terms of the two guys that are trying to run this state for the next 4 years, that are vying for that position as chief administrator, chief policymaker, chief cheerleader for that matter.
Right. And, you know, nobody really has asked them about it so far. I'm sure it might be posed to him before the last of the three debates are over. And, I don't know. I think Charlie Crist says that we all have to pitch in and start thinking and contributing to the cost of, protecting our shores and our the existing real estate property, that it's going to be take federal, state and local funding and resources. And Charlie, and as far as Rick Scott, you know, he's still kind of on the fence and keeps saying, I'm not a scientist. But it doesn't really matter whether you believe it's man-made or not. I think the evidence is indisputable that the seas are rising and that we will need to take measures in order to protect our property and quality of life.
9 inches in the last century or so. That is Mike Mayo with the Sun Sentinel. Joy Fletcher with the Miami Herald joining us. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. We did hear from some scientists this week as well. The Union of Concerned Scientists issued a report warning the frequency of tidal flooding, Joy, is expected to increase eightfold in just the next few decades for Miami Beach, even worse in Key West. What kind of grasp of the action needed now did you sense from local officials, and contrast that with what you heard from national policymakers?
Well, on a local level, I definitely heard a lot about changing building codes, changing the way that they approach development. I mean, there's really nowhere to retreat to on the island, so they have to talk about how they're going to safeguard what they have already. And on a national level, they were talking more about the whole state in general and how they were going to try to find the funding for different safeguards like pumps and keeping the water safe when you pump the water out.
What's so next for Miami Beach, particularly in its fight against the tides?
Well, it's going to be spending a lot of money. It's going to be talking about, yeah, what you do when you build. There is a lot of development currently, so they're going to be looking at how they develop safely, keeping the first floor high enough off the ground. But it's
are
it's
they talking about code changes? Are
yeah,
they are talking about code changes.
Building okay. code changes, yeah. Building yeah. code changes that are and as far as existing structures, I mean, I posed the question to the mayor. I was like, you know, what are you going to do about what exists? There's, I mean, it's very built out already. And they're not completely sure. They're going to have to figure something out.
I think we might have to look actually to the Midwest and Chicago maybe for some solutions as far as like raising buildings and things like that, because they went through this. I guess I was fascinated to hear this about the end of last century, where I guess they were having some problems with flooding with the various waterways that flow through. And they embarked on this project where they basically lifted all the buildings that
were
already
Two things happened. As odds would have it, I know plenty about Chicago, being from the Midwest and living there for 20 years, guys. Chicago was built on a swamp, essentially. It was the smelly onion. That's what Chicago, in fact, can be translated to. And what happened was they had a great fire where a good part of the city was wiped out by fire. And when they decided to rebuild the city, they built it with the swamp in mind and required the homes to have half basements so that the first floor was significantly above the elevated ground. They also built out and landfilled a lot of the lake in, and so now the lakefront in Chicago is a lot built on the ruins of the 1871 fire.
There you go. So maybe we have to fill in the ocean. I don't know. That's a tall order.
Joy Fletcher, we'll let you go here. Joining us from the Miami Herald in Doral, Joy Fletcher writing about Miami Beach for the Miami Herald. Mike Mayo with the Sun Sentinel. I'm Tom Hudson on the Florida Roundup. On Saturday, Jean-Claude Duvalier will be laid to rest. Baby Doc Duvalier ruled over Haiti for 15 years before fleeing in exile in 1986. It ended a 29-year reign by the Duvaliers, first by his father, Francois, and then Jean-Claude. Baby Doc died last weekend. There's still calls for justice, in part because of the funds he allegedly stole from the Haitian treasury, and as well as human rights abuses under his regime while he was leading Haiti. Nadege Green is joining us here in studio with WLRN. What kind of legacy do you think Nadege Baby Doc leaves?
It depends on who you ask. There are two different legacies viewed through two different lenses. For those who were part of the regime, for those who were positive towards Baby Doc, he leaves behind a great legacy. They feel that he is someone under his rule. Haiti was thriving economically. The streets were clean. Tourism was a viable trade in Haiti at that time. But for many, he's a tyrant.
It came at quite a cost.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, he tortured, he killed his militiamen. The Tontomacut were feared. And for many of those who suffered those human rights abuses, whose family members were killed under his regime, he is a tyrant who is not worthy even of a national funeral.
Yeah, and he will not get the state funeral when he is laid to rest, in fact, tomorrow. Jackie Charles covers Haiti for the Miami Herald, and she joins us from Haiti. Jackie, as the country has had 6 days or so to kind of process Baby Doc Duvalier's legacy, what are your impressions left?
Well, what's interesting here is that there's no real outpouring of grief in the streets of Haiti, whether it's in the capital of Port-au-Prince or in a city like Port-au-Prince or in Cape Haitien. I've been to all three of them in the last week. You know, what's interesting is what, you know, Nadege said in terms of his legacy. But remember, this is a very young country, and they are devoid of memory. So for a lot of the young people here, what they know about Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier is what they have heard about better times in Haiti, quote-unquote. But for people who lived through that era, both him and his father, they are basically saying, good riddance, let's turn a chapter, it's time to move on. So tomorrow's funeral service is going to be very interesting to see who comes, who shows up, what are the departing words, and also what happens to him. Is he buried, or will he be cremated like his father was?
It's interesting you describe Haiti as a young country, because the Haitian history has it gaining its independence in the early 1800s. It has been an independent country from France.
I think she meant demographically.
But demographically, yeah. Exactly. And Nadege, you are nodding your head in terms of that. It's a very young population that may not necessarily even remember life under Duvalier's.
Even here in South Florida, I mean, when the news hit the streets of Little Haiti, I was out there, and I went to Notre Dame the next day, the Haitian church in Little Haiti, a Catholic church, and many of the young people were of the mentality that, yeah, you know, we heard he did some bad things, but, you know, we also heard many positive things, you know, the poor weren't as poor under Duvalier. The Haitian good was worth more under Duvalier. And so people were able to live. And even though they themselves did not experience this, they were recounting what their parents said. Even their parents who lived under the regime, some of their parents were telling them, well, you know, he was bad, but yeah. Look, things weren't bad for me.
Mike Mayo.
One thing about dictators is that they do bring order. And, you know, whether it's Haiti or Iraq, I mean, I don't know if, you know, 10 years from now or even now, you probably have people say, wow, well, you know, Saddam, for all his faults, at least, you know, we had some order and prosperity. Again, it's one of the things where you got to move forward. His legacy obviously is mixed. And but, you know, the bottom line is he was a ruthless dictator who followed in the footsteps of his father.
And Jackie Charles, real quickly, if you could, what are the calls for continued justice, continued investigations into the crimes, the alleged crimes that were undertaken during Duvalier's reign?
Yes, there are very much calls for this. I mean, with the victims have said, okay, it's a shame that we're not going to be able to have our day in court with him there. But he was not the sole person responsible for what happened under the regime. There are other people who worked in his cabinet, who was part of his government, that should be that also should be held accountable. So the calls for that are continuing. Amnesty International put out a communique and others. So we're going to see what happens. I mean, it was a significant step that the government of Haiti, which has a number of individuals who formerly served in Duvalier cabinet, currently are in this government, that they decided that they were not going to have either a national funeral or an official funeral for him. So that was huge. Now the next step is going to be, or at least from the victim's perspective, what are you going to do to, like, finally close this chapter? Will this case continue, or will it just die on a vine?
A question that still remains here today. Jackie Charles joining us with the Miami Herald from Haiti. Nadege Green covering the death of baby Doc Duvalier for us here at WLRN. And Mike Mayo joining us for the hour here on the Florida Roundup from the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Thank you to all three of you. Thanks to all our guests and callers. That is the Florida Roundup on this program, produced by Alicia Zuckerman and Julia Duba. Digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our executive producer and technical supervisor for this program, Peter J. Meritz. South Florida Arts Beat will be next, and we'll see you back Monday morning on the Sunshine Economy, Affluence and Affordability in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.